You're listening to Cards to the Moon, a podcast about trading cards from both a collector and investor perspective. We hope you'll stick around for the ride as we take a deep dive into the state of the hobby, share some hot takes, hopefully some useful advice and fun stories along the way. Hey guys, welcome back to Cards to the Moon. This is episode 175. My name is Clark from fivecardguys.com and fivecardguys on Instagram. With me co-hosting as usual is Hyung of Integrity Sports Cards. We had to shuffle our recording schedule a bit, so unfortunately John won't be able to join us today, but he should be back next week. All right, so off the top, the big chase in this year's Topps definitive set was the dual autograph card featuring Shohei Ohtani and Babe Ruth. And there are two one-of-ones. No, not duplicate super fractors, but there's a one-of-one dual auto of Shohei Ohtani and Babe Ruth, and they're both pictured batting on one card. And the other one-of-one is both of them pitching. All right, so you got those two of one-of-ones. Yeah. Anyway, the hitting version of that card was pulled by Filth Bomb Breaks recently. So first, your thoughts on these cards, like what you think of the idea of having a dual auto of Shohei and Babe. And second, I know it's hard to say, but how much do you think this card could go for?
I'm assuming the hitting variation might be the higher demand because it would be Babe Ruth in a Red Sox uni, maybe?
Oh, I didn't think about that.
Instead of a Yankee? I don't know if that matters to collectors, but like I don't know how much Babe Ruth pitched. But I think it was with the Red Sox. So I would be interested to see if that plays effect. But I will say Topps Definitive in general, I think it's a pretty expensive set. But I was watching a couple breaks this year, and there's some heat. There's definitely some heat in these sets. And it comes at a hefty price point. I think $2,000 a box.
Ooh.
Yeah, wow. So that's the only thing. Is it worth? Because we've seen high end sets in the past, like Topps Transcendent, and at really, I think they were like $25,000 a case or something like that. But crazy. The resale value on these products are garbage, to be honest. And I mean, it's a cool, and even looking at the design, not to knock Definitive, because there's definitely a lot of cool stuff to be pulled. But it feels like, you know, a basic graphic designer just created a basic template and then these guys just signed the cards, right? There's six autos per box. There's eight cards. And it feels like, yeah, I'm not completely sold on it. I don't think I would ever rip it. I do like the set in general, like just Topps Dynasty, Definitive, all these higher end sets. But I don't know if I'm in on this. Like, I think there's a lot more hype because of the whole Shohei and Ruth. And like we talked about in previous episodes, it's like there's another bounty on it, right? So is this inflated hype keeping this value of products the way it is, right? So yeah,
good point.
I mean, a lot of questions to be asked for sure. But like I'm a little less excited about this, to be honest. A lot of people think this is the greatest card that people have ever seen, but I disagree with that. Yeah.
I'm just showing you a picture of the pitching one, and it looks like it is in his Boston uniform, but you can't see Boston across his across his chest, right? So
I don't think that would matter. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it would matter. And then the batting one does have New York across it.
The batting one's definitely cooler, I'd say that.
I agree, 100%. Definitely cooler. And I think it's a cool idea. You know, actually, Will, our friend Will, our fourth co-host of the pod, he actually gave John and I on a separate chat a future segment idea where we come up with dual auto ideas across different sports. Okay, so we won't get into it here, but you know, this kind of reminds me of it. Of course, this is both baseball, but it's across two different eras, which is kind of cool. So I like that idea. But yeah, in terms of like the execution, yeah, it's okay. I mean, I would be ecstatic if I had a card like this.
Yeah, I wouldn't complain. Yeah, for sure.
Don't get me wrong. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, we talked about in previous episode where how many Babe Ruth cut autos are out there.
Right. You know what I mean? Yeah, they're like multi or mass produce these cut autos.
Jeez. And you know, then of course, if you're nitpicking, we talked about this as well in another podcast episode, Shohei's new auto is not as nice as the original auto, right? So those two nitpicking things, you know, I think Eric Whiteback, the collectibles guru on Twitter, values the card at $100,000 he values it at. I don't know how he gets that number, but
I think there was a bounty. I think
is that why?
I believe so. So I want to say Filth Bomb, the breaker that pulled the hitting one, basically had $100,000 bounty on it. That kind of sets the value up,
right?
Up there. Makes sense. But this is what we talked about last episode, where is this real value or manufactured value, where, you know, because, and you don't know what's going on inside, like the deals that are made, who knows? Like, and I don't want to accuse anybody, especially with our platform and stuff like that, but being real, like if you're interested in joining these or purchasing this as a long-term investment, just because the initial hype was like 100K, it doesn't necessarily mean that someone's willing to pay that. Or it could work on the other side. Maybe it's worth 500K, right? Yeah. If somebody's willing to pay that. But as of right now, it's a manufactured value that comes straight from, and I'm not saying that, you know, Filth Bomb is associated with any deals under the table, but like we don't know. We don't know any of this. So it's like, it's almost like tread with caution. We've seen kind of these big bounties in the past, which keeps kind of like the demand for breaking and ripping in general, because, and I don't mind it. Don't get me wrong. Like, I love that they're creating, you know, more incentive to rip, because I think the ROI on ripping without these bounties are like, well, you're going to lose out 99% of the time, or maybe it's like 95%. But yeah, it's just those things that I'm just more wary of, because I kind of see it more often with these bounties. Sure. I'm just questioning it.
No, that's reasonable to ask. You know, at the very least for me, even if there was nothing nefarious going on, of course we have no proof of it, but it's at least good marketing dollars, right? There's a lot of attention being put on these bounties. Who's giving out these bounties?
Right.
Like Dave and Adams, when they first issued their, you know, the Babe Ruth Retrofractor, I think it was 200K for that card. I don't know if it's a trend, but I'm already beginning to see that, you know, this one was 100K, right? The Volpe MLB debut patch was 150K. Right. So it seems to be going lower. And I think part of that reason is because the more bounty announcements, the more huge bounty announcements you get, it's not as unique. Do you know what I mean? Like the first couple that do it, they're like, oh, who's doing this? Who's giving it out? But if, like, you know, after the 10th huge bounty by a 10th different breaker, you just kind of forget who's issuing these bounties, and then it kind of loses its marketing purpose for the breaker or for the organization that's issuing these bounties. So they're like, okay, we're not getting as much ROI, right? So, you know, in the future, if this keeps on, you know, if this becomes a trend on providing big bounties, I could see it go down to like 20K, 15K, you know what I mean?
Because for sure, absolutely.
You don't get the value as much for those that are issuing those bounties. So we'll see if this is a trend or if this is, you know, I still, like you mentioned, I still like the whole idea of bounties, because it makes breaking or ripping more exciting, right?
Yeah, so for sure.
I mean, last weekend I just bought a Topps Chrome update and I was chasing the MLB debut patch just because of the stupid bounty. Which
there's all these, you know, bounties out, so it's like, might as well, right?
You might be lucky. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I don't know how the pitching one will do when that comes out, but we'll definitely mention it on our podcast once it does. Okay, let's move on now to hobby headlines. All right, so last week, or was it 2 weeks ago? But there was this big controversy surrounding Rob G, aka Sports Car Therapist, who we actually had on our podcast as a guest not too long ago. Now, I don't want to get into the details of what happened, because there's already so much commentary that's out there about what he did, about his apology video. And as of today, it seems all of his social media accounts and his popular podcast too, they've all been removed. But I thought instead we can try to be more constructive and talk about some of the lessons we can learn from this incident and hopefully be able to move forward as a hobby. But I will provide a little bit of detail of what happened just to give you guys some context, and I'll try to be as concise as possible. So essentially, Rob admitted to making what he termed, and I think you were attributing this to him, the term mega bid. Okay, he admitted to making a mega bid on a card, specifically on an Eli Manning Gold Prism number to 10, and I believe it was a PSA 10 grade as well. Right. And that sold for just under $1,900. And from what I can understand, this term mega bid is when you give a max bid during an auction that you probably think is well above comps to give yourself the best chance of winning the auction, mm-hmm. right? And you'd put in this max bid essentially to beat any snipe bidders that might, you know, have put in that last second bid just above the previous bid amount. So what eBay or the PWCC platform would do is automatically then see what your max bid is and beat that last second bid, and you obviously win the auction because it was higher, right? Right. So hope that makes sense. For what happened to Rob, he ended up winning that auction for the Eli Manning. But what stirred, I think, a lot of the controversy is that he admitted to not paying for that auction despite winning it. And his rationale in that apology video was that he thought the auction was being shilled, which just means that another bidder was just bidding up the auction to increase the final value of the card. That's a loose definition of shilled right. bidding. And the problem with this, in my opinion, and many others, I believe, is that A, the evidence for this auction being shilled is inconclusive at best. You know, you can't
right.
100% prove that the second bidder was shilling the bid to increase the value. And second, really, if you put in that mega bid, the assumption is that you're willing to pay that max right. bid you volunteered to put in to begin with, right? So, of course, there was a lot of feedback, both fair, some harsh, and everything in between. So, like I said, I don't want to really contribute more to that, but I want to rather focus on what lessons can we learn from this, not only from a collector perspective, but for even as a content creator perspective, which Rob G was himself, and we are as well. And you know, it'll be interesting to see what we would do if we were in a similar controversy that involved us in some way. So first, Hyung, what are your initial thoughts about this? I know that was a large preamble, but I just want to kind of provide
better context. Man, it's a tough one because I think what you're saying is the second shill, or what Rob was saying that it was shilled, the eBay seller ended up putting an offer to the second
bid
that, and he actually posted it on his yeah. Instagram that he received it. So there definitely wasn't, I think, a shill. Maybe that's what Rob told people. But at the end of the day, like I said, if you're doing this mega bid on any platform, you should go in with the intention that this is what you're willing to pay because you don't want to lose the card. And this yes. is, it is a PSA 10 pop one, and there's only one BGS 10. So these are the type of cards that you would apparently mega bid on. And I've done that before where I didn't want to lose mm-hmm. a card, and yep. I went over. And sometimes you get lucky and, you know, you win the bid because nobody ended up bidding higher, and you get the card for a lot cheaper. But like I said, there might be times where other people feel the same way, and you have two guys that are overbidding on an item that ends up right. skyrocketing the price, right? But obviously, you know, the person that paid for the auction, he thought it was worth it at the end of the day. I will say this though. Based on like my interaction with Rob and stuff and what he's given to the hobby, I think we have a tendency as kind of like hobbyists or collectors to crucify these influencers. Mm. They are influencers, but have your own kind of like, I guess, do your own due diligence obviously is important, and you know, taking responsibility kind of for yourself and your own actions. I think that that's key to really preach that side of things more so than always pointing fingers. And I don't think it's the same situation. Like, I wasn't a big fan of card porn for one. Like, card porn was, I thought, toxic, because they would promote negativity. They would bash small businesses where they wouldn't, those small businesses wouldn't even stand a chance. So it's like having a platform like that. And obviously the fraud investigation that, you know, card porn is under and stuff like that is a whole different story. And by no means should we be comparing these two incidents. I'm saying, you know, it happens a lot more than we think it does. There's a lot of I'll tell you right now, I show you my eBay. Like, there's so many people that don't pay for auctions.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm not going to go searching for them and then, you know, start crucifying everybody that, you know, doesn't pay for an auction at the end of the day. And those are little things that businesses like eBay or any platform should, you know, make sure that they're looking out for the best interests for everybody. So, and like I said on previous episodes, anytime there's incidents, it just shows that those are the problems that need to be addressed in the hobby so that we could make the hobby a better place. Instead of harping on the problems, you focus on the solutions, right? So I'm in the boat where, there's a lot of learning lessons to be had, but I think he's getting, and I think Rob personally took down a lot of his stuff because it's not worth it at that point. It's not like we're, like, at least us or other influencers are making millions of dollars off spending all this time and energy to create content. And then you just get literally, you know, crapped on. So it's tough. It's like, why would he put any more time in a place where...
Why bother, right?
You know, you're getting a lot of, you know, pushback on that. And I think it's more toxic to be a community that basically does this to people, right? Obviously, there's spectrums that people are innocent, but and then there's the spectrum of people are guilty. So there... It's tough because we're a new industry. We're a new marketplace in general. There's a lot of, you know, regulated stuff. We talk about this all the time in grading. There's issues in grading, how a grade can be that subjective and there's price points there. So that's an issue, but you can't always point your fingers at the issue necessarily, but bring light to it and create a solution instead.
Yeah, that's a good perspective for sure. And, you know, just going back to the whole megabit, I think most of us are in agreement that there is some fault with Rob for what he did. But to your point, I think the reaction has been just so blown out of proportion. And I would imagine why he, and not defending his action in any way, but why he would delete all of his socials is for the exact same reason you would. Like, is this worth it?
Yeah, it's not worth it.
It's different if you're a celebrity making millions. Then you're like, you got to protect your millions. And I'm going to go on an apology tour just so I can continue to have a livelihood. Right. But, you know, I'm sure he's like, I'm not getting paid anything for this. Yeah. And the backlash is ridiculous, right? But you know, there are consequences. And, you know, if you're willing to stay in the hobby, you know, you got to be at least trying to get some credibility back as best as you can. Like, it's you can't easily be... accepted with open arms. You can't expect that, right? Because people are upset, and I understand why people are upset, but it will take time to gain that trust back, you know. And that's, I think that goes to the last question I was asking. If it happened to us, we made a mistake, A, we own up to the mistake, B, we make that sincere apology, and then C, you work on it to gain the people's trust, to gain the collector's trust, the people that listen to your content. As long as it takes, because if you like what you're doing in terms of providing content, then that's one of the more important things, to gain the trust of the people listening to you. And then, you know, you can't control how they, you know, some people might never forgive you, but you can't control that.
No.
But others might say, like, you know, yeah, I think they're good guys. They made a mistake, and that's what you hope for, right? When you continue to provide content in this space.
I think a good point to mention too is if you're in that influencer space or you're trying to become an influencer, I think, you know, establishing that relationship, through your content will give you the benefit of the doubt. Like I said, if you watch Rob's content the last 2 years, he's given a lot of value to the hobby, a lot of value. So the people, I think, that are fans of Rob, I think they are on the side of, you know what, he did make a mistake or whatever it was. It is what it is. But that doesn't necessarily define his character, because like it, to me, he showed up, you know, the last 2 years giving enormous value at no cost. So it's like stuff like that where it's a learning lesson for maybe content creators out there that, you know, you brand yourself by the content and value you give. And if you focus on that, I think you will establish the relationships with your audience, or at least the backers, to kind of like say, hey, this is what happened. This doesn't define, like, if that happened to you, Clark, for instance, I wouldn't use that as against you, for instance, like saying this is who Clark is. You know, your consistency over the past 2.5-3 years should be speaking a lot louder than, you know, any one incident, because we don't know the complete story at the end of the day, right?
Yeah, no, I certainly appreciate that. I would hate to have one day you come on the pod and say, hey, welcome back to Cars to the Moon. This is Hyung and John, and that's it. All right, let's move on.
Yeah, I think I think I would take a seat if that happened. It's too much work for nothing.
Yeah. Hopefully everything works out. You know, the thing about the hobby too is like there's always something new going on, and it's like the news, right? The next thing that comes up, you kind of forget what happened just a month ago. So we'll see how this plays out at the end of the day. One last thing I want to mention. Yeah, I think if you're going to megabit, I love that this is a terminology within the hobby now, but yes, be prepared to pay no matter how much you actually win by. And I've done it too in the past as well. Like it's actually with that Luka Doncic blue contenders optic that I just won. I think I bid almost up to 7K.
Right.
And then the second highest bidder went up to 6.3. So I was lucky enough to get it for 6.35 essentially.
Yeah, discount. You know what I mean? You're at a discount, so it worked in your favor.
So it could work either way. But I was prepared to pay 7K if someone bid 6.9. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anyone that's not familiar with how that works on eBay or PWCC, just end of the day, be prepared to pay your max bid.
And,
right?
And but that asks the question. So is it should places like eBay or Goldin or any other auction house tighten up kind of like how these bids are being placed and consequences for non-paying? So it's like stuff like that where you can't always point the finger. And that's why it's like you could take a whole audience and I think it's more toxic that the hobby audience in general rely on these influencers to basically make the call of what's right or wrong, or policing the hobby. Right. Yeah. I think if everybody agrees to just have integrity and we all love the hobby and focus on that instead of always reacting to influencers. And this is part of the influencers where they just create the issue bigger than what it is because they have a platform to basically bring this issue up saying this is for the good. But what it is all it is content at the end of the day. Right. So, I think there's so many different lenses and perspectives to see this at. And I think building like a healthy community in terms of each individual saying, you know what, I'm in this hobby because XYZ. I love this hobby because XYZ. This is what I stand for. Therefore, I will not participate in that. And the more people that kind of jump on that, I think people in general, the people that I've dealt with, to be honest, I've been doing this for a while and I haven't had any bad interactions, to be honest. I've heard way more bad interactions, but it really hasn't been in my life.
Yes.
So if I'm always complaining, but it's not even happening in my life. It's that analogy where I forgot who said it. I seen if I told you, Clark, you know, how many red cars did you see, you know, today while driving? You probably say none. But then I say, how many, if I paid you $100 for every red car you've seen, you know, on your commute to work or whatever it was, you probably see a lot of red cars.
Right.
Right.
So you're looking for it.
Yeah. So for me, it's like, I don't necessarily look for the issues. And I think that's part of the hobby. It's like the drama that people like. And this is what card porn did. Well, it started hobby drama where the issues became bigger than they were. But then we're starting to look for these issues. So I think the majority of population have great experiences. They don't really have these negative experiences. Maybe once in a blue moon, you can't really control that. But we can't define the whole hobby saying that it's terrible because of this incident.
Right. Yeah. No, I totally agree. And, you know, ultimately, it is a kind of a fine balance. You don't want to, you know, look the other way when there are bad actors. And I'm not saying Robin was totally a bad actor, but when there are things that happen that are controversial, you want to spotlight them. And then really, like, at the end of the day, what I'm hoping to do with this podcast is, what can we learn from it?
Right.
And then let's move forward to make the hobby better.
Right? I love that.
And,
yeah.
And I think that's the best approach, in my opinion.
For sure.
Whenever things like this arise, instead of, you know, just kind of just harpooning them more and more, you know, and just making it really into a negative space. You know, and I'm pretty sure there's going to be more controversies in the hobby because it is a growing space, right? And you know, there's going to be things done that are shady, but yeah, again, when that happens, let's learn from it and let's right. go on. And as a content creator, the last thing I'll say for real this time on this segment is that I'm always conscious too of, like, when I talk about whatever issue it is, like, you never know when you're going to make a mistake,
right?
Like, so just to have that kind of grace for other content creators and you know, at least try to get both sides is always a useful practice. So that's yeah, it's a unfortunate thing that happened, and it's crazy that it blew up, in my opinion, to what it to how it's, you know, everyone seems to be talking about it constantly. But I also understand why people would want to talk about this as well. Okay, let's switch gears a little bit and we'll go on to our next segment, a more lighthearted segment. We're calling Cast Your Vote. Okay, so this is a new segment, and I got this idea because I saw MLB, Major League Baseball, they put out a couple of lists on their Instagram asking questions like, which current MLB star has the best chance to win their first MVP, and they give a list of some of the candidates. Okay, okay. So I want to kind of see what we would choose, like if we were casting a vote, and then I have a couple of other categories based on other posts that MLB put out. So I think this would be more fun to go through. All right, so let's start off. Yeah, let's start off with the MVP question, and I'm just going to pull up the social media post that they put up. So their question is, which current MLB star has the best chance to win their first MVP award next season? Okay. And this list is the best active MLB players without an MVP award, according to MLB.com. Okay. And let's see, there's 8 candidates, all very good candidates, as you'll see. All right. I'll just read them out loud, and then you tell me which one you choose. And then I'll go right after. 1, Nolan Arenado, no MVP. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., well, he's on the list. Francisco Lindor, Manny Machado, Jose Ramirez, Corey Seager,
ooh,
Marcus Semien, and lastly, Juan Soto.
Oh,
who
man.
Are you voting for out of that list?
To
next season. It's saying next season.
Next season.
Yes.
I know I'm going to get ripped for this.
Uh-oh.
I'm big on bounce back years. Acuña yep. had one this year.
Mm-hmm.
So the question was, is Acuña the same after his knee injury? He had a rough season and then he blew up, right? And
right.
we kind of hypothesized that before the season that, you know, the new pitch clock rule or the rules of picking off at first base was going to really help guys like Acuna and guys who can run is going to change the speed of the game. So
the bigger bases.
Yeah. So yeah, stuff like that where it benefits it. And I'm a big believer on bounce back years. The guys you mentioned, like the Arenados, the Machados, even the Sotos, I feel like they can be, candidates every year, you know, but like their production is usually solid, but never unbelievable. I'd say even with Soto, he would be the favorite candidate to win an MVP, but like, is he gonna, you know, contribute to his team's success? Is he gonna, you know, play enough defense where, you know, he makes a difference? Because you're competing with the Otanis, the Acunas, the guys that can kind of do both. Like, you look at the runner up, like, what's called Mookie Betts, for instance, can do both. You know, even guys like Corey Seager, who had a legit shot at winning MVP, kind of do both. Like, so you get guys like Soto, even Vlad, but I think Vlad can hit enough where he can maybe make a difference. And I think he had such a down year that, you know, you guys got to remember, like, baseball is a game of adjustments. You know, you find success, you feel good, and then the next year you're not in the same comfort, or, you know, pitchers do more video work on you where they expose kind of like that weakness of kind of like what your approach is. So it's an ongoing, you know, learning experience. And I think Vladdy's still a young hitter. So as a hot take, I'm going to say, you know, he almost got robbed of his first MVP. I thought he had an MVP season. Any other year, Otani basically took it from him. Any other year, I think he would have won MVP. So I'm gonna go Vladdy here. It's a little hot take because of the bounce back. I think he's gonna have a phenomenal year next year.
Okay, I think you are gonna get some blowback from.
Oh yeah, for sure. I don't care.
Calls of Homer. <You don't care. laughs> But you know, I hope you're right as a Jays fan.
he has to be hitting 40 plus home runs. Like, that's my expectation of Vladdy, a 300 hitter with 40 plus. So if he hits 330, 320, 310 with 40 plus, 100 plus RBIs, he might have a chance. His WAR should be up at the 7-8 level. So
yeah, no, I'm not saying that's a far fetched choice, but I'm a little surprised, to tell you the truth. I'll go next. I think I'm going to take off like guys like Arenado, Machado, even Ramirez off, and Semien. Like, I think age has a bit of a factor. And then I'm looking at the remainder with the teams, right? Because you got to be on a good team. That'll improve your odds, right? You know, and in terms of, I like what you talk about bounce back years. And I also like to think of bounce back in terms of the team, not just a player,
right?
Like, which team really underperformed? And in my opinion, San Diego really underperformed this year. And I'm assuming, and you know where I'm going to go with this now, I'm not choosing Machado. I'm choosing the other Padre currently, Juan Soto. And I think you're right. I think most people would say Juan Soto is the number one favorite out of this list of who could win their first MVP, because he puts solid numbers every year, right? Every single year. We say this all the time on the podcast. He starts slow, but we're like, never worried.
Yeah, 1,000 OPS, 900 to 1,000 OPS every year. He's going to have a positive WAR, so.
Like clockwork, yeah. And so I think Soto has the chance, because I feel like the team, if he stays on the Padres, the team, I think, can bounce back to the point where we expect them to be contenders, right? So that's a big caveat, I guess, a best big if he stays on the Padres. But if he goes to the Yankees, where, you know, there's some rumors, I don't know how valid those rumors are, there's always, you hate being in the AL East for that reason, because the Yankees always have the chance of doing really well at any given time, right? You know, and so if he goes to the Yankees, you got Judge there already, obviously, and you got a pretty solid batting lineup. They're aging, but still can do some damage. So even then, I think Soto has a good chance of having an MVP-like season as early as next year. So I'm going with Juan Soto. Boring choice. But the question I want to follow up with you, and you can go first this time. Vladdy, you actually, I know this answer already, but for the benefit of the audience, do you have his cards? Are you holding on to them?
I do. I do have one Vladdy card that I've sold. I sold Vladdy at peak. I was all on him in 2019.
Yeah.
So I did well with Vladdy in terms of kind of like getting rid of the cards at the peak. But I do have his Bowman first blue auto, a PSA 9, yes. That I think I believe in Vladdy as a hitter. Like I said, I've watched a lot of baseball, and I would say he's one of the best hitters in the game. People don't understand that, like, because they just see, oh, he's washed up. It's like, no, man, he could still hit. He's figuring it out. He's a young kid still. And and on the flip side, that just proves how good Soto is at his age. You know, you look at the walks to strikeout ratio. That's a big indicator of how good of a hitter someone is in terms of his plate discipline, his knowledge of the strike zone. And guys like Vladdy, where you hope that 1-to-1 ratio keeps up, Soto is above that. So he's I would say a better pure hitter, but Vladdy has the power potential to even put up 50, you know, and I know it's going to be tough to do that because the argument to Vladdy's side on the other side is his big year that he had, half the season was in Buffalo.
Right.
Right. So that's the knock on him. But like I said, he's 24 years old. He's still young. I'd say peak of someone's career would be that 28, 29 age, really, when they become, you know, full men. They've been in the league for 10 plus years, and they have a good idea of, you know, how to get it done at the end of the day, right? So, yeah.
Yep. Okay. I have a base auto, of course, the Bowman Chrome of Vladdy, so I'm holding on to him as well. And, you know, in terms of my pick for Juan Soto, you know, anyone familiar with this podcast knows by now that I'm in the market for Juan Soto.
So me too, yeah.
Yeah, I really like him as a player and him just improving year after year. So that's a no-brainer.
Yeah, no, Soto has amazing collectability, I think, in the hobby. Yes. I think that's what has Soto in terms of a collector standpoint. If I were to invest in either of them, you got Vladdy's prices are lower, but there's a lot more options for Vladdy as opposed to Soto. True. So the supply-demand is in Soto's favor for sure.
Yep, good point. All right, second, looking at all the big 2024 Rookie of the Year candidates. MLB asks, who do you think will rise to stardom next year? Okay. And they actually list one top rookie for each team, but we're not going to go through all of them because that'll take a while. But they did highlight just one from each division. So I'll just name those as they seem to be the current favorites to win next year's Rookie of the Year honors. We'll start with the American League. All right. From the AL East, they have Heston Kjerstad of the Orioles, which is insane, by the way, because they have Jackson Holliday coming up behind him. Like, yeah. The Orioles are going to be great for 10 years
without doing anything. They have Colton Cowser, too, who's going to be another hitter, too.
Jeez. They've done well with their farm system. So anyway, 2024, Heston Kjerstad's highlighted. AL Central, they got Kyle Manzardo of the Guardians. And for AL West, he's already played this year, from the World Series champs, Evan Carter for your Texas Rangers. So out of those three, or is there one that's missing for you? But those are the three probably favorites in the AL.
You never know with Jackson Holliday too. Like, this guy might be called up next year and actually make an impact at the big league level. He was a super young kid in AAA this year, like, and he held his own. He hit like 270, hit some homers, and for a super young kid to be in AAA and perform, I think that's something to note. He might be a 20-year-old big leaguer when it's all said and done, where he's making an impact at that level. Kjerstad, on the other hand, I think as a hitter, I like his upside the most. I think he's a solid hitter. He's a pure hitter that has a chance in a protected Baltimore lineup. So I like Baltimore's odds, you know, of producing young rookies in the next few years, actually. So their farm system has been unbelievable. They weren't even supposed to be the team they were this year. We're expecting them to be that next year. So yeah, I think just based on the team, I think guys like Evan Carter, though, like unbelievable, like call up. I don't think he might be that player throughout the whole season next year. And you see that a lot with rookie call ups. So you take 2019, for instance, guys like, who is it? Our boy, Keston Hira. You know, a guy who hit 319, 18 bombs his first year. It's like you're expecting that next year, and it's the sophomore slump, right? So I'm a little worried about that, because you got to understand, these pitchers go in and throw against the rookies, and they have a good season, and then they spend an off season. Teams start making, doing their homework on these players, and then it's exposing them. You know, being able to expose them. Happened to Tatis, happened to Vladdy, happened to, you know, Keston Hira, happened to, you know, all these rookies. And then it's their job now to figure it out, kind of, right? To make those necessary adjustments to basically bounce back. So I'm going to go Keston Hirstead.
Okay. I like that choice. I'm going to go with the short sample size, Evan Carter, who you're just talking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was just looking at the stats. This is ridiculous. 62 at-bats in the end of 2023, right? So he'll qualify to be a Rookie of the Year candidate for next season. But 5 homers, 3 stolen bases, batting .306. So that's pretty impressive for a rookie call-up. I like the only knock with, and it's not even a knock against Kjerstad, but they have so many great players. Do you think there's a chance of being overshadowed? Do you know what I mean? And especially if Holiday gets called up, I wonder if that's going to be one of those things where voters are, oh, I you know, I'm just not going to vote for any Oriole because they're
I think where Hirstad can really I guess benefit from it is he's a pure hitter. He can hit, right? So I think if he's in the right lineup where he's protected and he's not necessarily in the middle of the order, I think he could really, you know, perform at his potential. He's a lot older too, so he's gonna be a 25-year-old, you know, rookie. So more mature than the younger kids, where, you know, I think a mature hitter would have more of a chance.
True. Yeah. And to your point, Evan Carter is just 21 years old. There you go. All right. So that all being said, are you looking to pick up any other cards?
No. I'm not a big, like, even MVP race, I'm not a big guy on like playing the guessing games and saying, okay, I'm gonna buy this because I think he's gonna be the MVP.
Right.
I would purchase it because I'm like, okay, I really believe in this kid in general, and I think there's
long term,
maybe long term, but even like he's gonna have a good season, not with the intention that this guy's gonna win the MVP. Obviously, that's a bonus. Then you get the whole skyrocket price, right?
Yeah.
But even look back at Acuna, for instance. Mm. His prices from, I guarantee, from 2020, they've been stagnant. They haven't been going up. Even if he had an MVP season, they went down, and then they're probably recorrecting itself. But like, I'm not going to put too much stock in like the next Rookie of the Year. Guys like Corbin Carroll, for instance, might be a little different.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another guy that I really like, Pete Crow Armstrong. He might be on that side. I don't think we did the NL, but...
Yeah, well, we'll get to that in just a second. Just to put a bow on the AL, I think a dark horse candidate for me is Junior Caminero from the Tampa Bay Rays.
I like him.
He had a kind of a bad regular season, but I think... To your point, it goes the opposite way as well, right? You adjust depending on your circumstances and your situation, your experience being called up. You know, Mike Trout, same thing, right? Didn't start off
220 regular this year,
yeah. And then obviously adjusted really well. And I think Caminero is too good to kind of pass up right away in a partial 2023 season.
Right.
All right, let's go to National League. You did mention Pete Crow Armstrong, but he is not highlighted in the NL Central. You know why? Because there's a guy named Jackson Churio,
who's the
leader in NL Central that MLB has highlighted. The other ones, NL East, Ronnie Morocchio from the New York Mets,
yeah.
I believe. And in the NL West, it is Kyle Harrison with the Giants, a left-handed pitcher.
I'm going Jackson Churio on this for sure. Like, I was a big fan of him. He's a big, big-time prospect. I think he's rated number two on the top 100 list. So for me, it sucks that he's with Milwaukee, but he's 19 years old or 20 years old. Wow. Had his first season in Double-A this year, hit 22 home runs, hit 280, and that's with the slow start. I think he swiped 44 bags as well. So this guy's could be an impact player at the big league level, and I expect him to kind of be that guy. So I like Jackson Churio, even though he's a favorite. He's a guy that I would even look into, maybe not investing right now, but I think he'll be a superstar in the big leagues.
So yeah, it's interesting you say that because obviously you put Churio on a different level, right? Because based on what you said with the AL candidates, like this guy is super young, but yeah. I guess you're saying his talent is
It's different than, you know, like an Evan Carter, for instance. Like Churio is like, he was a potential number one prospect in the top 100 list. He's been top three in the last
pedigree,
2 years. Yeah. And, you know, what I've seen from, I was following him a lot last year, where he was struggling actually in Double-A. Mm. And he's 19 years old, rightfully so. You got older pitching, you got guys that can actually spin it, throw pitch backwards, you know, expose him for his weakness. But then by the end of the year, he made the adjustments, right? So seeing that from a young hitter just shows that he is a true hitter. He is a hitter that gets it and understands the strike zone very well. So I like Jackson Churio because you have the kind of like the marriage of hype plus performance.
Hmm. Yeah.
Right?
From the hobby standpoint.
Yeah, from the hobby standpoint.
Definitely a plus for sure. I'm just like looking at stats primarily to see if I could project some of these out, and Jackson Churio certainly stands out. So I'm with you there. Not much more to say other than I'm not buying any of his cards now.
Because, no, too high.
Yes, 100%. And you're going to look for that inevitable dip that happens when he gets called up, and then he has to get used to major league hitting or pitching. And then once that dip happens, if you really believe in him, you got to trust that he'll adjust as well to the higher level pitching, right? So that's probably the best time to buy. If you're looking for Churio,
I will throw one more name out there, and it might be a hot take because he might not even be in the big leagues next year. But there's this guy, James Wood. I think he is a monster. Like, he is a guy that can.
What team? Nationals?
I believe he got traded in that deal with the Nationals. But I really like his size, his game. He's a pure hitter. He hits for power. So there's a lot of, I guess, upside with James Wood. Can he be in the big league roster? Who knows? But he was in Double-A last year. He hit 26 bombs. 18 of them came, you know, in Double-A as a 20-year-old. So he's still young, but he has the size that can really, I think, make an impact with that. And then the PCA comment was, I see so much with Pete Crow Armstrong. I see a lot of similarities with Corbin Carroll, actually. Corbin Carroll, I think, has a little more pop than Pete Crow Armstrong, but very similar players in terms of the dirtbag type that just is a good, good baseball player, right? So that's what I see with PCA as well.
Nice. Yep. And I concur. Pete Crow Armstrong, I think, is the dark horse out of that list. And James Wood isn't on this list because there's another higher prospect in the Nationals organization, according to MLB.com. His name is Dylan Cruz, who is also an outfielder. But James Wood is number two ranked in the Nationals organization for prospects.
I actually do really like Dylan Cruz, too. I think he's going to be an impact player in the big leagues as well. Whether he makes his debut this year is to be determined. It all depends on how he starts off. Probably starts off in Double-A this year.
Yeah. That's what it looks like he's at now in Double-A. And yeah, these guys are big. Dylan Cruz is listed as 6'0", 205 pounds. And like you said earlier, James Wood is 6'6", 6'6" and 240 pounds.
So I like that upside. Yeah.
Big boy. All right. That's Rookie of the Year. One last thing to end off the segment. The Hall of Fame ballot first timers were announced recently for 2024, the ones that are eligible next year, and it includes our boy Jose Bautista, right? But the rest of the list is as follows. I'll just read them out to you right now. One second. All right. And I think there's a partial list, but the names are Adrian Beltre, Joe Mauer, Chase Utley, David Wright, Bartolo Colon, Matt Holliday, that's Jackson Holliday's dad, right? Adrian Gonzalez, Bautista, as I mentioned, Jose Reyes, Victor Martinez, James Shields, and Brandon Phillips. Wow, this brings back awesome memories because that's the time when I really watched baseball. My question here is, any of those guys do you think will be a Hall of Famer on their first ballot?
First ballot, here, let me pull up the list. Do you have the list? I think Beltre is a guy. Yeah. Adrian Beltre. I grew up actually when I was with Seattle, he was in Seattle. So he's actually this guy's yoked, but he's a lot smaller than everybody thinks. Like he's not as big. So it's like I love the way he played the game. He was such a good hitter. He was such a clown. That's what I remember about him. He always enjoyed himself. Everybody around him enjoyed him. So I definitely think Adrian Beltre is a Hall of Famer. There's another guy that I thought deserved a lot more was Abreu.
Mm.
Bobby Abreu. I think he's such an underdog in terms of his career and what he's done. I think he has a shot, but I don't think he's going to get the love, to be honest, because he's not as well liked, I guess, even in the hobby.
Yeah.
Who else was on the list?
David Wright, injury concerns. You think that's going to be too much for him to overcome?
Yeah.
Chase Utley and Joe Mauer probably are.
Joe Mauer's a Hall of Famer. I think Joe Mauer's a Hall of Famer.
100%. First ballot or eventually?
Not first ballot, eventually. I would say I would pick Adrian Beltre out of that.
Yep. From all the reports, the hands-on favorite to make first ballot Hall of Fame is Adrian Beltre, for sure, with his, 3,000-plus hits.
He's unreal.
It's incredible. Incredible career. And you always see those highlights when he fools around with Miggy on the base paths, that's always fun to watch as well. And one person that's on the list for the last time, I believe, before he is not qualified to be on the list anymore, the 10-year rule, is Gary Sheffield. Do you think he makes it this year?
Man, I wish, because for me, Gary Sheffield was a guy I grew up watching.
Yeah,
I think he definitely deserves a Hall of Fame. And if it's his last go at it, I think I definitely want him in. Anybody who hits 500 plus home runs in the big league in their big league career should be a Hall of Famer, to be honest.
And anyone you could just remember growing up emulating his swing because it's so distinct.
And
it's always fun to do.
Unreal how much bat speed that guy generated with his the way he hit. It was so fun to watch.
Yeah, agreed. And is it fair to say to end off this segment, in terms of investing in his rookie cards, they both kind of grew up in the junk wax, so you're not going to get the value you hope to get, but great for the PC collection if you're a fan of theirs, yeah?
Absolutely. No, I'm a big fan of Gary Sheffield, so he's someone that I would PC for sure.
Cool. Okay, well, that puts a wrap on that segment, and we'll see how things shake out, and we'll revisit this at the end of next year around this time. Let's end off our show with a regular weekly segment we call Pick One. Okay, so this is when both of us will put up a couple cards or a couple players, and then we debate which one we would rather invest in. Okay, so do you have one to start off with, Young?
Yeah, we're gonna go with that Babe Ruth Shohei Ohtani.
Ooh,
one of one. Okay. Would you rather have that card? Okay. Would you rather have that card with a 100K bounty?
Yep.
Or a 1933 Goody Babe Ruth PSA 7 that sold for $96,000.
Oh, man. You know what? I thought it would be easy. I was just going to say like, oh, the Babe Ruth rookie or the Gaudi, right?
Yeah.
But then I'm like, oh, but the Shohei is on that too. So,
right.
Oh, that's sneaky. No, I'm going to go with the Babe Ruth. I for PC, I might choose the Dual Auto.
Right.
Because that's a cool card. But in terms of value, like you were saying, I think it's pretty manufactured. I think that's going to go down before I even think, you know, before it even has a chance to go back up.
Right.
So I think in terms of value, the vintage card, it's a safer bet. So I'm going with the Babe Ruth Gaudi.
Nice. No, I kind of match these up on purpose to kind of prove a point because there's no way I wouldn't choose the 33 Ruth. Like, right. Absolutely. Well, obviously the grade is the kicker on this card because just to give you an idea, the PSA 7 is a pop 21 that sold for $96K. The PSA 8 is an even lower pop that sold for $800K, and then the PSA 9 sold for 4.1 million. So, just to give you an idea of manufactured 100K value, is that true value, or you know, would you actually have an investment piece worth that 100K thinking that it has more potential in the future, the rarity, the history around that. So I think I wanted to just prove a point that, you know, we're chasing all this phantom stuff because Fanatics is doing their thing. They have a job to sell the product, but we got to be real. Real is real. As an investor, I'm going with the 33 Gaudi.
Good point. Point taken. And I hope others do too. All right, I'll end off with my pick one, and it's the Battle of the Jacksons, okay? Jackson Holiday, his first Bowman Chrome Auto base, we'll say PSA 10, last sold for about $500, okay? And the Jackson Churio base, his first Bowman Chrome, PSA 10 last sold for $800. Mm-hmm. So there's a premium on Churio, but which one would you invest in with that price point?
Ooh, that's a good one too. If Churio was on a different team, I would pick Churio. Mm. I really like his upside. He's like the Acuna type player. Like if I would say, who would the next Acuna be? It'd probably be Churio.
Ooh, high praise. Yeah,
very high praise on Churio. Same with Jackson Holiday though. Like this guy's super young. He's in the best kind of climate. Not climate in weather, but climate as an environment with the Baltimore Orioles being super young. You know, they have lists and lists of prospects that are going to build. It might be a special case this year where, you know, Baltimore is going to be very, very good. Very good. So I like that mix just itself and the price point, the fact that it's 30% cheaper than Jackson Churio. Yeah. So I'm going to go with Jackson Holiday.
Okay. It was easy for me because it is when I try to think about which prospect I want to invest in, just as a kind of a prospecting game, because it's so unpredictable how prospects will turn out, especially in their first year.
Right.
The sure bet is to always go, and if their talents are similar, and not even similar, but they're on that same kind of elite level, you know, Jackson Holiday, Jackson Churio, you would say they're both elite top prospects. If they're on the same level, I'm always going with the lower price point.
100%. Right? I was going to make that exact point because that's so important to know because you know the history of cycles of Bowman Chrome, right? It's like when they're expensive, that's when you sell because there's this enormous amounts of hype and then, you know, you buy low. So you got to go with the lower price.
Yep. And that's the point I want to make with this Jackson Holiday versus Jackson Churio pick one.
It's a good one.
So it's a holiday sweep. All right. Thanks for joining us for another podcast episode of Cars to the Moon. We appreciate you guys. If you haven't rated us 5 stars, wherever you listen to your podcast, we would appreciate it because it helps us a lot in terms of getting, more people to listen to it. So we'll see you again for our next podcast on Friday. Talk then. Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to Cards to the Moon. We'd really appreciate you subscribing to our podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can also connect with each of us on Instagram at 5cardguys, or you can follow Hyung at Integrity Sports Cards, or John at TradeU at Recess. You can also check us out at 5cardguys.com. Thanks again, and hope to connect soon.